everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Lara Romans, and I'm joined today by our producer, Elliot, who did a super interesting interview with filmmaker Ernest Dickerson. You might know Ernest Dickerson from working as a cinematographer with Spike Lee, but he also has an impressive resume as a director with the likes of Juice starring Tupac Shakur, Bones starring Snoop Dogg, as well as episodes of TV shows like The Wire, House of Cards, The Walking Dead, and Dexter. Elliot, tell me about your conversation with Ernest.
Yeah, Lara, I think there's a theme developing. This was another fanboy moment for me. And for people that don't know, Spike Lee is one of my favorite directors, and some of his best films are often because of the way they look. And the person responsible for that is Ernest Dickerson. The two of them met at film school together, and he was telling me their first conversation they had was them talking about their dream movie to ever make. And they both said Malcolm X. Yeah, Ernest Dickerson, he's incredible. I could have spoken to him for hours. His knowledge is incredible. He's like an encyclopedia. He knows names from every era, all the influential people. But I think it was so nice to see how passionate he was about film. When you get that big in terms of creating so much, you can perhaps maybe get disconnected from the rest of the film world. But he seems to be very much inspired by everything that he watches. He gives some great anecdotes of what it was like working with Tupac Shakur, because Tupac Shakur, when he starred in Juice, wasn't a rapper at that point yet.
And, oh, really?
Yeah, and this was his first leading acting role. So he talks about what that was like and how actually he saw moments within the production of the film that he thinks inspired a lot of Tupac's writing, which was really interesting.
That's crazy. I had no idea that was the way that happened.
Yeah. And then another interesting thing, he goes into detail about the making of Do the Right Thing, this film by Spike Lee, which is an all-time classic. And he talks about how he looked into the psychology of colors, because if you've watched that film, you'll know you feel a real sense of heat and tension. Yeah. And he looked at how colors can affect your heart rate, how submarines often have cooler, bluer colors to bring your heart rate down. And so he wanted to do the opposite. But yeah, it was a really, really cool conversation to have. We've stayed in touch since,
you're besties now?
Yeah. And he's going to send me a copy of Juice, which I'm really happy about.
Oh, that's so cool.
Rather interestingly, we managed to briefly talk about it, but he made this film called Double Play, which is about Curacao. And so, yeah, which is also a really interesting film to watch. He has a really interesting discography or filmography. So I think people will really enjoy it. I learned a lot just from speaking to him. I was trying to get to the bottom of what it was that, or how he came up with all these sort of iconic shots. So he's known for making the double dolly shot, which is a Spike Lee returning classic where you put both the person and the camera on the dolly. So it gives this idea that they're both floating. Right. But often he would keep repeating that it was sort of just in the moment and sort of trusting yourself and all this stuff, sort of the usual cliches. But from him, it sounds even more inspiring. So I hope people enjoy the conversation.
Well, I can't wait to hear it. Let's dive in.
Ernest, welcome to Celebrating Cinema.
Thank you.
It's a real honor to have you here. For me personally, I think your films with Spike Lee really opened the world of cinema to me. And when I say that, a film like Do the Right Thing, I remember watching that when I was 19 at university. And I think it was the first film that I really understood the power of cinema, simply because that film, which we'll talk about, you really feel something as you watch it. And I think, while I'm sure you'll probably be very modest in saying a lot of it's down to Spike Lee, I think actually the way that story was told visually opens it up to a lot of people to understand exactly the heart of that story.
Thank you.
But on this podcast, we always start by asking our guests their first formative memory of cinema.
My first formative memory of cinema.
Yeah.
The earliest movie that I can remember seeing, I was probably around 4 years old. I remember I was in Boston, and it was a movie about a giant octopus that destroyed the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it was playing on a double bill with like these zombie guys that had these, looks like they had these holes in their head, that the top of their head had been taken off and their brains replaced. And I found out later that it was a double bill. It came from beneath the sea. And the giant octopus was done by the late, great Ray Harryhausen. And the other one was called The Creature with the Atom Brain. It was formative for me because it affected how I see the ocean at night. You know, whenever I see the ocean at night, I keep thinking that maybe there's a giant octopus out there someplace.
I'm not surprised. I mean, it's quite a, it sounds like quite an intense film to watch at 4 years old.
Yeah, yeah. Well, my cousin Vita used to take me to see a lot of horror films growing up. So that's probably one of the reasons why I developed a love of horror.
Yeah, because you're quite a big horror fan.
Yeah, and science fiction, because my uncles used to read a lot of science fiction. So
were you watching a lot of films as you were growing up?
Yeah. I used to, Saturdays when I couldn't play, we would go to Saturday matinees and see movies. And then Sunday evenings was always a great time to see movies. But I grew up at a time when I remember seeing Jason and the Argonauts in the movie theater as a kid. I loved adventure films, especially if they were in the more fantastic side. When I was a kid, I went to see the first James Bond film, Dr. No. Now, I was in Catholic school, and the Catholic school was frowning down upon, the Catholic Church was frowning down upon the Bond films. I heard about Dr. No, and what fascinated me, it has science fictional elements. That's the thing that's always interested me, I think, about James Bond. There's always been a science fictional element to a lot of the stories. And so that's what drew me to it. And I went to see it, and I think I was in the fourth grade. And when I went back to school the next day, I told my classmates, and they said, "Ooh, you went to see that movie with those naked ladies?" it turned me on to James Bond.
Because you went to film school, I believe, in New York. What was sort of the realization that I want to start doing this yourself?
I had always been interested in the craft of filmmaking. But being a young black guy growing up in the projects, there was nobody there to really tell me that that was a career perspective, something to look forward to. So actually, I went to undergraduate school for architecture. I got my undergraduate degree in architecture, but I developed a love of cinema. My mother always loved films, so we would always have films playing in our house. It was films and jazz. My uncle, who was the first man to put a camera in my hands, he actually made me realize that movies are photographed. I didn't know why certain movies looked the way they did. There were some movies, but that one, oh, wow, why does it look like that? And one night, we would sit up late at night, and watch great movies. He turned me on to so many old classic films. One night, we were watching David Lean's Oliver Twist, the 1948 version. And he had been dabbling, he was a jazz musician, but he had been dabbling in black and white photography. Really been showing us some beautiful black and white prints he was doing. We were sitting there watching the opening of the film. And he just said, "Damn, this photography is amazing." I said, "Oh, photography." And I started equating what I was seeing, in the movies with what he was producing, that there is a photographic process. And I said, "Oh, movies are photographed." And that's when I really started to realize who this person in the credits called the director of photography did. And then not long after that, I saw the movie In Cold Blood. And beautifully photographed by Conrad Hall. And that really turned me on to photography. So that's where it started. But it was years later that I really started thinking about it, because I went through 5 years of architectural school, but I took classes in cinema with Haile Gerima at Howard University. And all the work that I got was in photography, all part-time work. So that's when I had to sit down and, what do I see myself doing for the rest of my life?
You're already mentioning a lot of names of people that have influenced you, at least in your cinematography, perhaps. But I wonder how you yourself develop your own visual style, because it is very distinctive. And while I think you have often been inspired by a lot of the great cinematographers that have come before you, I think you also have built your own distinctive style. And I wonder how you're thinking about that, whether it's a conscious thing or what's inspiring you or leading you to craft something more unique to what people have been familiar with in the past.
Well, my favorite saying is that creation is a patient search. For every project that I've done, the search is there to, what's the best way to visually tell the story? And I guess I'm attracted to films where the visuals are primary, and you know that the movie could exist without dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, so trying to find ways of telling stories visually,
yeah,
has always been the main thing, and also, you know, to get the audience to feel what the characters are feeling. That was that was the foundations for the visual structure of Do the Right Thing. Mm. And Spike actually gave it to me earlier. He said that he wanted me to think about what's the best way to get the audience to feel the hottest day of the summer.
Good morning, Miss Mother Sister.
Now, Mookie, don't work too hard today. The man says it's going to be hot as the devil.
I've been here 25 years. LaSalle's famous pizzeria is here to stay.
Trust me.
Mookie, the last time I trusted you, we ended up with the sun.
And I had always been a student of color photography, color photographs, because I also studied still photography as well. People work by people like Gordon Parks and Jay Mazel and Pete Turner, people who use color expressively. And the cinema of Powell and Pressburger, where they use color expressively. So, and Spike, also being a movie lover, you know, he, quiet as it's kept, he's a big fan of MGM musicals.
Yeah.
He loves musicals. We would always reference films and think of ways we could put a different spin on it, you know, because most of the films that we grew up on and looked at did not have African Americans, did not have Black folks in them as main characters. And so I had developed a system for photographing African American, you know, Black skin that just came out of shooting a lot of Black folks and knowing, you know, how to, you know, put their skin tones on the grayscale. And, you know,
because I think for context, often a lot you saw before your films of the way people would shoot darker skin tones, it would often be in shadows, so you actually don't actually see the texture of their skin.
Yeah, or they would try to pour a lot of light on it, so it really kind of flattened them out. I found it very easy, but other people didn't. you know, it was crazy because... after I had photographed Wesley Snipes on a couple of films, afterwards, whenever he did another movie, he would always have the director of photography on that film call me
really
to tell them how to light him. You know? And I was like, oh, Wesley, come on. But it was good.
I do want to talk about Do the Right Thing. I think for context, so when this conversation gets released, we will have screened Do the Right Thing again, actually, and it's going to be part of a film program about films of resistance. And we're going to be speaking to two people based in the Netherlands, one who is a hip-hop rapper who has then gone on to create his own Dutch TV channel for Black people, basically, sort of telling Black stories. And another is someone who creates sort of this online archive of Black history and educating people in that respect. And the reason why we're showing Do the Right Thing, I think, is because, in a way, to me, it reflects the sort of foundations of hip-hop and the essence of hip-hop, how that is then applied to filmmaking. And I wondered, talk a bit how hip-hop has influenced both your approach with Spike to filmmaking, or if not, maybe. But I think there's a certain similarity, let's say, in the sort of DIY nature of just going and doing it yourself, but also how the story is told. It's very authentic to the Black American culture of the time, I would say.
Truth be told, didn't listen to a lot of hip hop. Public Enemy was one of my favorites. You know, I definitely, you know, had their albums. I grew up listening to jazz. But, you know, the thing is that the creative process, so much of the stuff that we do is unconscious. It is unconscious.
Yeah.
It's a lot of times there's not a method that you can really think about it. It's you know, like I said, creation is a patient search. And sometimes you get to the point where, okay, this feels right. This doesn't, but this does. And, you know, the rhythms of the film, that came from Spike's directing and the editing, you know, Barry Brown editing. The look was to really get the feeling of the hottest day of the summer. And so my use of color, you know, using color to, you know, I did a study of color. Certain colors make you feel heat. Certain colors actually increase your heart rate. Reds, yellows,
Didn't you look at like submarines or something?
Yeah, submarines usually have cooler colored interiors, blues and greens and everything, because it has a tendency to calm everybody. They don't want agitated people in a submarine. But reds and greens and earth tones, you know, those warmer tones, they increase the heart rate and get people to feel the heat better. And so the great thing about it was that Spike bought me in a full month early in pre-production so that I could have that influence on the production design and the costume design and the use of what colors to use and what colors not to use, but also to select the street, because the hardest part of it was that we were going to be shooting for 8 weeks on one street and I had to make it look like one day. And the weather in New York is variable. You know, you get beautiful sunshine one day and you can just get rain. And we had rain for like, I think the first 2 weeks. So, you know, just it's problem solving.
And I know you're probably again going to tell me that it's sort of just feeling your way through the creative process. But I'm glad you also mentioned jazz, because I think, well, I wonder how jazz has influenced your approach to cinematography, because I also see there is some kind of a relation, especially in sort of your rhythm of shot selection and the movement you create within your use of camera.
Not just jazz, but funk.
Mm.
I'm more a student of funk than hip hop, you know. I mean, and the blues.
Yeah.
You know, I'm a big Jimi Hendrix fan, but I'm also a big George Clinton fan, a big Funkadelic fan. I grew up with Parliament Funkadelic.
Mm.
And so in the 70s, those bands were big when I was in undergraduate school, and they used to come to my college and perform all the time. So the whole influence of funk. So I would say, you know, music influences that probably had something to do with my style. Jimi Hendrix, George Clinton, Miles Davis, John Coltrane. Those are the musicians that, Stanley Clark, you know, I mean, that's the stuff that I listen to and probably, you know, had more of an effect.
But it's interesting that music can have an effect on something more practical.
Yeah.
In that way.
Yeah. I mean, I love funk because, you know, as a kid growing up, James Brown was a major influence on me. And Rick James and Prince.
Yeah.
Big fan of Prince. So
you also mentioned how you and Spike would sort of look through cinema history to find sort of how you can apply what they're doing, but build on it. And I think one example would be the iconic double dolly shot from, because I think it comes from Melvin Van Peebles' film.
I don't think so.
Oh,
no,
really?
No.
I read that somewhere.
No, how that actually started was on Mo' Better Blues.
I want a man who knows what he wants.
I know what I want. My music. Everything else is secondary.
What you and I do is not make love.
What would you call it, Dan?
It's definitely not making love.
You ever heard of the Mo' Better?
Mo' what?
Mo' Better makes it Mo' Better.
What about Delvin?
Spike wanted the camera to follow his character as he's trying to go home, and he sees these gangsters sitting out in front of his car. And he said he just wanted it to be almost like his point of view. And I said, and I think we figured it out. Well, why don't we just put you on the dolly and put the camera over your shoulder, you know, and then as you're going down, and then when you walk away, we'll just turn you around and have you walk back. So he loved that.
Yeah.
And so then he wanted to do it on the next film, which was Jungle Fever. And really the idea was to get the feeling that you get when you're walking. Because even though your body with the steps is moving up and down, you don't see that. You don't feel that. You feel as if it's a smoother motion going forward. And so that's where we took it to another level. And then we took it to a whole nother level in Malcolm X, which I thought was actually the best one.
Yeah.
Because it does have this kind of out-of-body kind of a feel to it.
I think I also, again, read somewhere that Malcolm X supposedly had this feeling at the time that
he was going to...
Yeah, he was walking to his death almost.
Yeah, he knew his days were numbered. And we just wanted to get that feeling, and that with the music.
Yeah.
And then meeting the lady in the street, saying, just keep on keeping on.
Son, are you all right?
It's been
are you okay?
here. Good. I recognize you. Don't you pay them folks no never mind. You just keep right on doing what you're doing.
Yes, ma'am.
I'll pray for you, son.
Well, thank you.
Jesus will protect you.
And he knew he wasn't going to be there that much longer.
Could you talk about the shooting of Malcolm X? Because you wanted it to shoot, I believe, as sort of this great epic story similar to David Lean films.
Well, yeah. You know, the thing was is that there had been so much disinformation about Malcolm and his life that we wanted to correct that. We wanted to really put Malcolm right in front of the audience. We wanted them to see who he was.
What's your name?
Malcolm Little.
No, that's the name of the slave masters who own your family. You don't even know who you are. Who are you?
Say Roseland.
Roseland!
He was a pusher, a hustler, a thief.
You ready to tackle the streets?
Yeah, I'm ready. Let him come.
He was loved, respected, convicted.
State your number, Little.
I forgot it.
In a dream that's divine.
He was a prisoner who set himself free.
A Muslim must be strikingly upright.
I will not touch the white man's drugs, his liquor, his women,
so that those in the darkness can see the power of the light.
I will not lie, cheat, or steal.
I believe you will remain faithful. Yes.
He was a follower who became a leader.
You're not an American. We didn't land on Plymouth Rock. Plymouth Rock landed on us.
He brought honor to disobedience.
I suggest you look outside that window.
You've been laying down and bowing down for 400 years. I think it's time to stand up.
All right, break it up. You got what you wanted.
Nah, I'm not satisfied.
One of our favorite films has always been Lawrence of Arabia. And the restored version of Lawrence of Arabia had just been released. Spike and I went to see a great print of it at this great theater in New York. 70mm print. And the thing that really struck us, yeah, it's got beautiful landscapes and everything, but the close-ups you felt that he was really right in front of you. And that's what we wanted to do with Malcolm. So we actually hoped that we could shoot it in 70mm, but the cost was prohibitive. And even then, still, even if we were able to shoot it in 70, if the projection isn't up to snuff, then it would just ruin the whole thing. And we found out that had happened on there was a Tom Cruise film that was shot in 70mm. It was shot in Ireland, Far and Away, I think, something like that was the title of it. And they said that, you know, sometimes, you know, the projection, 70mm projection had gone by the wayside. So people didn't know what to do with it. And the projection was bad and it would ruin the look of the film. So we wound up not doing it that way. But Spike really fought to tell his story. And what's great about it, when we first met in film school, the first day we met and we started talking about our dream projects.
Yeah.
You know, what do you want to do? I don't know. Well, one of them we want to do the autobiography of Malcolm X. Yeah. You know, and you don't know if you're ever really going to be able to do it, but we did. And it had to be epic because Malcolm's life was a journey. He wasn't just one man. You know, he went through several different, you know, incarnations in his life. And we had to bring that out. And so Spike had to fight the studio because the studio just wanted like a 90-minute movie. They didn't even want us to go to Egypt. They wanted us to go to the beaches of New Jersey. They said, all you need is sand and do matte paintings. You don't need to see the real pyramids. And Spike prevailed. And, you know, we just tried to really give it that the feel of a man's life, the different stages of his man's life, from the 1940s of his gangster phase to his prison days, and then finally joining the Nation of Islam, and then finally his Hajj, the different stages of his life. And I gave each one a different visual feel using color and camera filtration to show the journey of his life.
The most powerful thing about that film and his story is just how human he is. Mm-hmm. And since that we are all capable of what he was able to go and do, but also how complex of a person he was. And
very complex, yeah.
He captured that.
And, you know, we were only able to tell some of the story.
Yeah.
You know, there's so much there. I mean, the movie is over 3 hours long, and I think we just barely scratched the surface.
With films like Malcolm X, Do the Right Thing, and Juice, which we'll get on to, what is it about cinema that makes it such a powerful tool for social change or for, yeah, just having a certain purpose within society of sharing stories? Because I think, for me at least, it's something far more powerful than other art forms at times when done right.
Well, visual storytelling is probably the most powerful in the world because, you know, people who can't read, at least they can respond to images. They can be told a story just by seeing what's happening on the screen. I've heard of stories where they show movies to people in countries that have never seen films, you know, folks out in the outback, you know, and living in areas that have never seen a movie. And silent films, they always responded to because it's pure image. And when you can see that, that's where you really can tap into it. That's why repressive governments always first take control of visual images. They always first take control of the film industry, and now it'll be the television industry. I mean, what we see happening in the United States, I think we're all in danger.
Yeah.
We're all in danger. So, but that's what the Nazis did. The first thing they did was took over the movie industry.
Well, you can see when visual media is also used as propaganda.
Mm-hmm.
And how powerful that is.
It is, yeah. Yeah, look what the Nazis did with movies. You know, they had their propaganda films. Leni Riefenstahl, you know, she made some of the most powerful propaganda films honoring, you know, the Nazi regime, you know.
Yeah.
Hitler's personal filmmaker.
Yeah. Well, as we talk about sort of these complex figures or complex people and sort of how flawed they can be, I think this is where Juice comes in.
If you want respect, you gotta earn it. You gotta be ready to go down, stand up, and die for that stuff if you want to, Juice.
Check this out. It's gonna be a piece of cake, Q.
Yeah, man, it'll be a piece of cake. We go in, right before 11, get the loot, and jet. I got a DJ Saturday night, you know what I'm saying? I'm not trying to miss that for nobody. GQ!
First one to ask, though, what was it that made you want to sort of switch and start telling your own stories, but also in a way that was distinctly different to what you were doing with Spike at the time?
Juice actually started, I co-wrote it with an old friend of mine, playwright from Howard University, Gerard Brown. And it really started when I was at Howard University. After my first year, I stayed in Washington, D.C. for the summer, and I had a job working at the post office.
Yeah.
And at the post office, every morning you had to check in before 7 o'clock. So I'm on the bus going to work at like 6:15, 6:30 in the morning. And I would see kids on the bus. You know, kids that look like they had been out. I'm talking about 5 and 6, 7 year old kids.
Oh wow.
Maybe 9, 10, but they were not teenagers yet. And it looked like they had been out all night. And I wonder, what were they doing? And, you know, I had a very adventurous growing up, you know, growing up in the inner city in Newark, New Jersey. And I wonder, what were these kids doing? I bet you there's a movie there. Mm-hmm. You know, so that was kind of like in the back of my head for many years.
Yeah.
That I wanted to do a thriller involving kids.
Mm.
After I graduated from NYU Film School, there was a period where I wasn't working, you know, I do the occasional music video, and I was also photographing some public relations films for the Archdiocese of Brooklyn. And so Gerard and I started writing what became Juice. And it was one of the things that was really horrifying us was the prevalence of guns, that guns were becoming more and more prevalent in the hands of kids. And that really was horrifying us. And we wanted to do a thriller, a film noir, about, you know, kids dealing with that issue. I interviewed some youngsters. Actually, my wife at the time, her brother had some friends, and I interviewed them. And a lot of their experiences kind of fueled the script. And Gerard and I wrote the script. I wrote the first draft. You wrote the second draft. And then we did the third draft, the final draft, which is the one we took out. And my career as a cinematographer started to take off. And Gerard had a career as a playwright. He was at the Public Theater in New York, Joe Papp, the great theatrical producer. Yet his play was playing down there. I tried to get it to my agent. My agent read it and said, nah, nobody wants to make this. This is around 1981, 82, 83, 81, 82, 83, because I shot my first film in 84. And he said, nah, nobody wants to make this. You know, you won't be able to. And I said, I can't sell this. He said, no, you won't be able to sell it anyway. Nobody wants to make this kind of movie. And so it sat on the shelf. We just, been there, done that. Put it on the shelf. My career as a cinematographer took off. I shot my first film, Brother from Another Planet. You know, then a couple of years later, shot Spike's film, She's Gotta Have It. And things started taking off from there. And life goes on. And then Gerard it was around 1990. Gerard was going to get a new agent. And he was interviewing this one agent, and she wanted to see some film stuff that he had written. Most of his stuff was plays, but he had this one film that we wrote together, Juice. And he showed her Juice. And she said, what's going on with this? He said, nothing. She said, I can get this made. I can set this up. And he says, oh, come on. Everybody told us that nobody wanted to make this. I mean, I had even shown it to some friends of mine that work for Spike, some folks that work for Spike, and they thought it was too dark. They said, no, this is too dark, too violent. You're not going to get this made. You know, and she said that she could get it made. And so next thing we knew, there were several production companies that actually wanted to buy the script. They wanted to buy Juice. And we said, okay, wow, that sounds pretty cool. That sounds all right, okay. Then they started sending us notes. The changes, they liked the script, but they wanted to make some changes. And one of the changes was they did think it was too dark and they wanted to make it a comedy. They thought that we should make Juice a comedy. A coming-of-age story, growing up in Harlem. With a lot of jokes and funny stuff. And all the notes that were coming through, Gerard and I had a heavy talk. We said, look, man, we can make money on this, but we got to look at ourselves in the morning. And we saw so many movies on television, you know, on HBO, movies that looked like there was a great idea there, but it just got developed into a piece of shit. Excuse my French. But it just got developed into shit. And so we said, thank you, but no thank you. We took the script back, and we said, okay, well, that was that. And then one day I got a phone call from a young guy named David Heyman, who was looking for his first film as a producer. He had gotten our script from one of the production companies that wanted to turn it into a comedy. And he said he read the script and he wanted to talk to me about it. I went and I told him, I said, look, this has to be real. It has to be raw. It's got to be, there's no actors that we know that can play this, play these roles. We got to get unknowns. And it's got to be, it's not a studio film. It's got to be shot, on the streets of Harlem. And he liked what I said. And he said, okay, can I get funding for it? I said, yeah. So he raised $3 million. Now, David Heyman was the son of John Heyman, who was partners with Chris Blackwell at Island Records. And Island Records had the offshoot, Island Pictures. And so that's who funded the film. And we made it independently. And he had two partners. This was their first film as producers. And We made the film in 91, 92. It was released in 92. And it worked out really well. Now, David, this was his first film as a producer. Found out later on he had gotten The Galleys to a novel that had just come out about a young boy who was a wizard who went to a school for wizards. And he bought the rights to it. The Harry Potter films. Yeah. So he wound up producing all of the Harry Potter films. Wow. And the movie Gravity and a whole bunch of other stuff. But Juice was his first film as a producer.
Oh, wow.
But we made it. And casting, you know, we went looking for unknowns, you know, and really cast very wide. I had my casting director, Jackie Brown Carmen. I told her, you know, she had to look at high schools of the performing arts, church theater groups, local theater groups, and find, you know, kids. And she really went through a whole bunch of them and hundreds of kids and narrowed it down. And so I started doing auditions on some of them. And that's how I found the cast and ultimately discovered Tupac.
Yeah. Could you tell us about that? What was it about him that led you to cast him as Bishop?
Well, I had a hard time looking for Bishop. You know, there was a lot of young guys, young actors that were coming in and thinking all I had to do was go ballistic, you know, really, you know, play with a lot of anger and everything. And that would get him the role. But none of it was working. There was a texture to Bishop's character that they weren't capturing. And so I was getting desperate, you know. I didn't know what I was going to do. And then one day, Tretch from Naughty by Nature came in to audition. And he did a pretty good job. Mm. And then he had this guy hanging out with him. And I said, what about you, man? You want to audition? You know, I'm getting desperate. You want to audition? He said, me? He said, yeah, sure, why not? So I gave him the sides for, you know, the scenes that involved Q, the character that was ultimately played by Omar Epps. And he went away. And he did the scene and came back and did a pretty good job. I already had Omar. I wanted Omar as Q. David and the other producers, they weren't convinced then, you know. So I had to still look for other guys. But then after he did that, I asked him, could you stay a little bit longer and read for Bishop? And he went away and came back about 45 minutes later and did it, did the audition. And knocked it out the box. I asked him, you know, what's your name? He said, Tupac. I said, oh, wow, that's an interesting name. What is Tupac? He said, it's a Mayan deity. And I said, what's your last name? He said, Shakur. I said, are you any relation to Asada Shakur? He said, yeah, that's my aunt. Oh, man, really? You know, Asada Shakur, a.k.a. Joanne Chesimard.
Who, for context, was part of the Black Panthers.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And she was... Yeah, you know, how is she? Because we knew that she had escaped to Cuba and was living in Cuba. So he said, she's fine. I said, okay, we'll tell her we're thinking about her. And he did it. And the thing was, what he was able to realize in Bishop was the pain behind his anger, the betrayal, you know, the helpless feeling. You know, that vulnerability was what he captured in it. Found out later that he had studied acting at the Baltimore School of the Arts. Mm. He had studied acting and ballet, which is really interesting because if you ever saw him walking, his feet were—he was always plié'd. You know, he was bow-legged and he was always kind of plié'd. So, and I understand that he used to get a lot of heat from some of the guys, because he was taking ballet, they used to call him a sissy and stuff like that. So he had to, you know, fight back. So that's how we found him. And he had not recorded anything yet. He was still a roadie and a background singer for Digital Underground. But while we were shooting, he always had a notebook, and he was always writing. And we were shooting on the streets of Harlem, and every now and then you'd see him walk over to somebody, you know, a young lady who looked like she was having problems, or an older lady who looked like she was having problems, you know. And I like to think that what he was doing was meeting people, because that's what he loved, meeting people. And And I think that's what ultimately fueled his music. Years later, my wife, Rose, and I found out that while we were directing him in the movie, his management company had just taken him on. It was starting to push him into a recording thing. So he was rising in both disciplines at the same time.
I always find it remarkable what he was able to achieve in such a short space of time.
Worldwide. Yeah. I mean, he's still recognized to this day worldwide. And really, really brilliant young man. Very volatile, you know, but brilliant. And love to miss him. Really miss him.
With the Juice, maybe some of our audience may not realize, but it was really a big cultural moment for Black America at the time. It was, as I understand, really well loved, and I think has passed on through generations that it's still being quoted by people who watch it today, which I think speaks to just how significant it was at the time to have told this story when you did.
Which shocked the living daylights out of me, because I didn't know that until my daughter. I didn't know that until my daughter told me that that she and her friends, they had juice parties where they would like watch the movie and recite the lines from the movie. Yeah. I said, "Oh, come on, get out! Are you serious?" Yeah. She said, "Really, Dad?" So I'm happy that it's endured to this day.
What I was wondering is, you make a film like Juice, but then you go on to work on The Wire, which, again, for me, is one of the best TV shows of all time. But what was it about The Wire that, because I feel like The Wire and Juice have some a crossover and themes, but what did you see there that you felt you were able to do or interested you to be telling a similar story, but for TV, let's say?
Well, what was great about The Wire, I have been a big TV watcher. I look at movies. Now I look at more TV, but I saw in The Wire that it was a totally different format for American television. It was a format that had really come out of England, where you had one story that you tell over several episodes. Most American television was one episode, one story. You know, it's a crime show. You know, the crime is committed, discovered, detectivized, you know, and, you know, gone to court and sentenced within 1 hour, you know, which isn't an hour because it had commercials. So it's usually like 45 minutes. But The Wire wasn't like that. And what I loved about it was that going to work on The Wire, they wanted a filmmaker's perspective. The producers wanted a filmmaker's perspective. They didn't want what television directing had become, which is what Gordon Willis, the late great cinematographer, called the dump truck school of directing, where the director just shoots every single angle they can think of, and they let the editor put it together. But to me, that's not directing. Directing means every scene has to have a point of view. The point of view determines what you see, where you put the camera, what the camera sees and what the camera doesn't see. Because, you know, you might be spending a lot of time that you could be put else somewhere, spending a lot of time on something that you're never going to use, and which is the way movies are done. And to me, that's always been a way of protecting a cut. And on The Wire, they wanted that perspective. They wanted somebody, you know, all the directors that they wanted were filmmakers. And that's what I loved about it. And we were shooting on the streets of Baltimore. We were shooting in... we had a couple of existing sets that were, you know, what you always do in television.
Yeah.
Because you have to have sets to go back to. But but we did a lot of shooting on the streets of Baltimore. We were always shooting, like, near crack dens, near where crack dealers were selling their product. And they hated us because we were driving there, scaring their product away. But what was really interesting is that... the police loved us because they felt it was like a real valid, you know, explanation of the life of the police. And also I love the fact that The Wire didn't make any value judgments.
No.
It just said, this is the life that some people have, and they're on opposite sides of the law.
Yeah.
So that was the wonderful thing about that.
Another question I would like to ask is about double play.
Welcome to the living paradox that is Curaçao.
Uh-huh.
Almost 40 years have passed, and it seems like nothing has changed.
We don't have much, but we have the sun, which is free.
A very famous taxi driver lived here once. A legend.
The revolution! You're here in Amsterdam, and Double Play is about Curaçao. If you could talk a bit more about it, but I think for our Dutch listeners, I think they'll be particularly interested to know how you came across this story, because I'm from the UK and I didn't really know about Curaçao or Suriname, these former Dutch colonies, until I moved to the Netherlands. So it's always quite interesting when people outside of the Netherlands come across such stories like you have.
Wow. Well, I first got hip to Curaçao through my friend, the great artist and filmmaker and sculptor and painter, Felix de Roy.
Mm.
Felix and I went to film school together. I shot his graduate thesis film at NYU. And then a couple of years after that, he and his partner, Norman De Palm, brought me down to Curaçao to shoot a movie called Almacita de Desolato. We shot that in 85, 86. And then in 89, I shot another movie for them, Ava and Gabriel. And these were films that played here in Holland. And really great. But it turned me on to the island, and I fell in love with the island, and I started going there on vacation.
Yeah.
And truth be told, I was there with my wife, Rose, one Christmas and New Year's. We were there with 10 wonderful days. I'm taking a lot of photographs. And I was like, I would love to shoot another movie here, but I don't know how that's ever going to happen. And several months later, my manager sent me a script that had been given to her by Lisa Cortez, the producer. That was an adaptation of Frank Martinez Arrion's book, Doublespel, or Double Play. And I read it, and I knew who these guys were because I'd spent a lot of time in Curaçao, and she was looking for a filmmaker because the film had to be shot in English, and she was looking for somebody to pull it together. And we did. We were able to pull together a great cast. We had a great producer, Gregory Elias, who really helped us make the movie the way it should be made.
Yeah.
And we shot it in 2014, yeah. And had a great cast, and I brought Felix on as production designer.
Yeah.
It was a chance to work with my friend again. Yeah.
And what was the heart of the story, just for people that haven't seen it?
It's a story of life, love, marriage, adultery, revenge, and murder that comes to a head between four friends in Curaçao during a game of dominoes.
Okay.
On a hot summer Sunday in 1973.
Yeah, so a real bit of everything.
It's a journey of life. And that's the thing about dominoes.
Yeah.
Dominoes as a game is reflecting of life.
Mm.
Nations have been bought and sold on games of dominoes. So.
And what our final question we always ask all of our guests is what your hopes are for the future. It's a very big and broad question, and you can answer it in any way that you like.
More films. I want to make more movies. My wife and I are producing some stuff now that, you know, we've written some stuff, and we're trying to get it made. There's one script that we did that we're in the process of turning into a graphic novel.
Okay, cool.
Right now, so we're in the middle of that. And several other films that we're trying to sell. It's very slow. It's a very weird time in the film industry.
Yes.
And because we don't know what's going to happen with the new administration. So, but it's a weird time. But, you know, we just keep pushing ahead.
Well, Ernest, I want to say thank you. I think it's no coincidence that you have been around some of the most, for me at least, some of the most influential people of Black American cinema and creating that, because I think you yourself have also been very instrumental in creating that yourself. It really has been an honor speaking to you, and may you continue making films.
Yeah, I mean, if you ever want more questions at some point, just let me know.
I would love that. And I'd also like to say thank you to Rose, who has joined us and sat with us during all of this. Thank you.
Get tickets to our next film club, Todd Haynes' Ode to Glam Rock, and the best musical biopic that isn't actually a musical biopic, Velvet Goldmine. You'll find tickets for that in the show notes. Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzahl and artwork from Studio FFF.